springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Sirius XM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough! Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, and sorry about that. I'm on the phone with Dave Hill, and as I had mentioned, earlier, when before Vic came on, as I knew I would bring this up with Dave, Monday morning, and they're running the Sports Center Top 10, and I hear all of a sudden I hear Lake Hamilton, and somebody quickly looked over, and here's a Top 10 play where Sylvan Hills throws a three-quarter length of the court shot that wins at the buzzer. And Dave, that didn't bother you at all, did it?
Not one bit. No way. Because the Lake Hamilton Wolves stink. They've always stunk. And I'm glad that they're getting dunked on national television. Because I'm a Trojan. I'm a Hot Springs High School Trojan. And we never liked the Wolves.
So this is is this going to cause a problem at home? Is your mother going to get catcalled in the grocery store?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, these rivalries run deep. There's so many generations of people in that town who are on one side of this divide or the other. But you know, the thing about Lake Hamilton is they've always been an incredible football program. You know, they're a statewide contender, and they used to crush us in football every year. But we would spank them in basketball. So. So that was the sport we could beat Lake Hamilton in. Those country boys out there could play some football, though.
Where's Sylvan Hills?
Sylvan Hills is a part of Arkansas. It's not like a local school.
Oh, wow.
It's not one of the three high schools in Hot Springs.
Speaking of, and how we, you know, this is how we careen into crazy topics. Did I ask you after last year's visit, about that, I think I did, about the college. I came across this, that college. I found this little baseball stadium, and I discovered that there's like a real college in Hot Springs.
Well, there's National Park College in Hot Springs. Yeah. And, you know, that used to be a community college, and now it's sort of a bit of a junior college. It's a good school, and they've got, they have a great basketball program there too. National Park College is, right there in the middle of Hot Springs National Park.
I was like, what is this? And there's a beautiful new baseball stadium that their team was practicing. And I sort of wandered into it inadvertently.
Well, baseball's big in Hot Springs. You know, there's a lot of baseball history in Hot Springs.
And, right.
They've actually built a number of new baseball parks around town recently in the last few years, including kind of a historic park that used to be the park that, you know, Babe Ruth and a lot of other famous baseball players used to play on, that they've restored a bit. And then the old boys club now has a really big and really nice baseball facility. So I think because of the history, the connection to baseball history in Hot Springs, there's a lot of love and care for baseball locally.
Well, and I've told people and I've put up plenty of pictures on social media of the baseball, the historic baseball tour, and you basically go around town and there, you know, you do a QR code and you know there's audio that corresponds to each of the signs, and of course Worthington Park, which is unbelievable, and in the back corner. In the back corner of a Weyerhaeuser office, there is a home plate where the stadium at Worthington Park was. And it famously, I think Babe, hit a home run in spring training into the Gator Park. That landed right. That landed in the pond in the Gator Park, well across the street.
Yeah, I've heard this story before. I don't know how apocryphal it is or not, but it's a great story.
Exactly. There's an unusual circumstance. Went looking this morning, as I always do on Thursdays, to get the column and make my notes. And I discovered that there's a wildcat strike going on at the Times.
Well, it's not a wildcat, I don't think, because the contract has expired. But, yeah, there's a 24-hour strike that started at midnight last night. And I filed my column yesterday morning. It got edited, but it hasn't been published. I'm assuming it's strike-related, and that's fine with me. One of the things the union is asking is for folks not to, click on any links there today. So it's good that I don't have to worry about anybody reading my column there today. I did tweet out my pick for Thursday night just in case anybody was curious about it.
Well, let's first of all note that another positive outcome for you last week. And in fact, it could have been a banner week, honestly. Very easily. I think you ended up 9-5-1 and could have been 11-3-1.
It's 9-6. And there were a couple of games that I felt like, that slipped away. But the problem with that, with talking about it that way, is that, there were also games that I won that could have gone the other way, too. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So I try not to beat myself up too bad about the games that we missed by, a half point or by some crazy random thing happening at the end of the game. But it is true that there was a moment where I felt like I had a lot more games won there at the end. That's the NFL, though. You can't ever look away, because teams can score a lot of points and pretty quickly sometimes.
Well, then there's the team that couldn't score despite two unbelievable opportunities. The Jets losing that game to Minnesota is inexcusable.
Yeah, it was depressing. It was really depressing to watch. And it's funny because I was watching it on Red Zone, and they kept, when you watch football in Red Zone, they kind of click to every game where the team's in the Red Zone. They just kept clicking back to it, and I kept wondering, is this the same possession? Nope, the Jets are back. they kept getting the ball back, getting back in the Red Zone, and then failing to score touchdowns, and it was driving me nuts, because the defense was doing the job, just like they've been doing all season, but the offense could not execute in the Red Zone, and I picked them, so that one won the L column.
Well, and even though it wouldn't have helped you, I ended up watching that Bucks Saints game on Monday, or was that Sunday? When was that? Was that Sunday night or Monday night?
Yeah, let me look. It was Sunday, I think.
It was the Monday night game. I felt so bad for this Andy Dalton. I have no connection to Andy Dalton, but Andy Dalton played fabulously well. And I guess, Saint fans, anybody took the Saints, they covered. But I know you took Tampa, but Andy Dalton deserved to win that game. And any of the four or five key drops that he suffered, any of those would have been enough I mean, the Saints should have won that game 27 to 10. It was ridiculous.
I agree, and I was rooting for them because at a certain point in the game, I even tweeted this. I said, if the Buccaneers can't cover the spread, they deserve to lose. So, and I knew that they were, it was impossible for them to cover at a certain point. So I realized that because they were laying 3.5. And so I started rooting for New Orleans to beat them straight up because, I don't want Brady to win if I'm not going to get credit for
it. If I'm not getting paid.
And I'm sick of picking this guy. I mean, whatever. I picked him again this week, so I need my head examined. But I can't figure the Buccaneers out. I'm always on the wrong side of them. When I pick against them, they cover, and when I pick them, they can't.
The Brady, it's gross. Let's get a handle on the week, and without my guide, you may have to
sure.
Dave, take the wheel because
I've got a few that I bet. I'll sort of let folks know what I bet and what I like.
All right.
I'm assuming that the full column will be up tomorrow since this is just a 24-hour strike. The editors will probably get it up in the morning. But tonight, I tweeted this out already, but I'm taking the Rams and the points. And I think that if you want it, you can get it. I got it at 6.5. Looks like it's going to 7. So I might be on the wrong side of that since the market seems to be giving more points. There must be some action coming in on Vegas. I could check that too. But I mean, look, we got Baker Mayfield showing up in LA. I kind of liked LA even before I knew Mayfield, Baker was headed there. Just because I felt like it was a lot of points against a team, the Rams covered last week against a team that's a lot better than the Raiders. They covered a pretty similar number. So I felt like this was a situation where, we talk about this a lot. I'll tell you this week, I've got a lot of favorites this week. I'm not all on underdogs, but this was one in particular where I felt on Thursday night the Rams could pull off a cover. I think that they lose this game, but I think they lose by 3 or 4 points here. I don't think that it's going to be that big of a whooping here. And it looks like there's a lot of money. I'm opening up now. There's a lot of money on the Raiders right now at 76% of the money. So I might be on the wrong side of that one, but that's who I picked. And my numbers show the Rams, even with before I knew Mayfield was coming, losing this game by maybe a field goal. Does Baker Mayfield add more or less? It's hard to know, He's had a tough season, but he's got to be an upgrade. He has to be. So if you get the stomach for it, if you have the stomach to sweat a bet on the Los Angeles Rams at this point in the season, then that's where I'm at tonight.
All right. As far as I can tell, the best part of Baker Mayfield are those commercials.
He definitely secured the bag this year, if nothing else, with all the commercial money that he got.
All right, let's jump to Sunday then, and I'm curious which of the home favorites, mostly home favorites, that you're interested in, because there's some big home numbers.
There are, and I'm laying it this week, and that's not my style, I know, but I'm laying it with the Bills. I got the Bills at 9. It's at 9.5, so I got it at a good number. I think this number's going to 10. So I would grab it today at 9.5. You can get it 9.5 at a lot of places, but Circa's already moved the line to -10, -110. So, they're a sharp book. I think that's a sign that might be where it's headed. So I'd grab this 9.5 while you can get it. But I think the Bills, I mean, look, we just talked about the Jets and their struggles in the red zone and Buffalo's defense is a pretty formidable red zone defense. So I think those struggles will continue. And, just generally the Bills are there. They score the highest number of points at home in the league. They've got 34 points per game at home average this season. Their red zone defense is the third best in the league. I just think that this is a tough spot for the Jets. And I think the Bills can cover this at home.
There you go. 9.
And they have a lot of incentive too, because they need the top seed. They need home field advantage. The last two seasons, their playoff run ended in Kansas City. So I think they'd like to make Kansas City come to them this year.
Well, and the Bengals showed that that's part of a formula anyway.
Yep.
All right.
I've got Baltimore. And interestingly enough, Baltimore is getting points on the road. They're the underdog here. They've lost Lamar. And I think that the market is saying that, hey, that's too much for this team. Steelers are going to beat them at home without Lamar Jackson. I don't buy it. I think that even without Lamar Jackson, Baltimore can beat Pittsburgh. I think it'll be a close game, like every Baltimore game is. Every, you know, Baltimore is, you know, they do just enough to win. but, you know, I think that based on, you know, what we've seen this season from both these teams, I think Baltimore can pull it off without Lamar. So I'm taking the points with Baltimore on the road.
All right.
This is, you know, hold on to your hats, folks, if you really want to tail my bets this week, because I am taking Denver against the Chiefs. I am taking the points. You know, I took 9.5. Now, Pinnacle's already moved this number to 8.5. There's obviously action on the Broncos. So you should grab 9.5. You can get it still at a lot of places. You can get a pretty cheap 9.5 at PointsBet. Look, Denver has one of the best defenses, if not the best defense in the NFL. They can keep games close. And I think this is going to, you know, and yes, they're playing against the Chiefs, who score a lot of points. But Kansas City also, their defense has been a little bit leaky, and they've been allowing a lot of points. So I just think this is a game where, you know, a strong defense against a weak defense. I granted, Denver can't do much on the offensive side of the ball. They're a mess, but they don't need to do much. They just got to keep this game, you know, within 9.5 or whatever number you can get it at. I think that it's probably safe to say that if it gets much lower than this, I don't know that I would take Denver +7 if it gets to that. But 9.5 points, I'll take it. Denver's at home. You know, what we used to call Mile High, they're, you know, 5,200 feet. You know, it's a tough stadium to go into. It's a good home field advantage there. Denver maybe has one of the best home field advantages of any team in the league. And so I don't think Denver wins this game. I'm not saying that at all, but I'm willing. That's one where I want to take the points, and I hope I don't regret it later because this team is just garbage.
speaking of lines and a lot of points, and of course you were concerned before the game started that Dallas had to cover that number against India.
Yeah.
The other day, that was the Sunday night game.
They covered it, didn't they?
they covered it. Yeah, in the fourth quarter they covered it. 16.5 this week, and did you see the money line number on Dallas?
Yeah, it's crazy. Right, let me see what it is right now. Right now, it looks like it's -1429 is the best number. -1700 in a lot of places. Oh, yeah, bookmakers got it -2000. I mean, it's outrageous, but you know, it's because, you know, it's the worst team in the NFL by a long shot, and one of the sort of surging best teams right now. So it's sort of a perfect opportunity. This is the biggest spread we've seen this year. It's, you know, it was 17. Now it's 16.5. So this is the biggest spread. I think it's justified as the biggest spread of the year. These two teams are completely outmatched from each other. Having said that, I'm nervous about it. I picked Dallas in the paper. I'm not betting any of my own money on this game. I would be nervous to have to cover the number. You know, Dallas did whoop up, you know, on the Colts last week and put up these massive numbers against them. But like you said, they did it all in the fourth quarter. At the end of the third quarter, that game was what? It was like a 3-point game. Yeah. So, you know, and I was nervous. And, you know, then they piled it on. I mean, part of the dynamic of that game is that the Colts a little bit gave up. And, you know, even though Dallas, I don't think, was trying to run up the score on them, the Colts just kept choking up the ball on offense, and the defense was giving them this great field position. And, you know, what are you going to do, right? Even if you want to run out the clock when you're on the 10-yard line, you know, you're just going to keep running the ball in. So that's a little bit what happened there. But all the same, Dallas is easily, you know, at least 15 points or more better than – they're at least 2 touchdowns or better than the Texans. And Texans are experimenting with their quarterback. You know, they've got – they're trying to get the number one pick. They have no incentive to try to win. So I don't want to bet on it, but I think I picked Dallas to cover the number.
All right. Well, so far we got the Rams tonight plus 6.5, Bills minus 9 Sunday, Baltimore plus 2.5, Denver plus 9.5. What else are the prime plays?
Well, I like that. I'm betting on the Bucks again, and I hate myself for it because they keep I'm wrong every time. But this may be the week that I get this right. And look, they're visiting the formidable San Francisco 49ers, but the Niners lost Jimmy G. They lost their quarterback. And so there's a big question here about how much of a change. I mean, the Bucks are still getting points. They're getting 3.5 points going into San Francisco. And, you know, I think that as good as the Niners are, and they are good, they are still, you know, strong enough to win this game. I think it's still an unknown about how they're going to play without Jimmy Garoppolo. And I think in that situation, I'm going to take the points with Tampa Bay. I think what we saw last week with that sort of that drive against the Saints that we already talked about, you know, this is a team that if a game is close coming down to the end, they'll figure a way to cut out a win here.
Yeah.
And so Tampa Bay's defense has to figure out, this is two really good defenses, and I think it's going to be a low scoring game, and taking the points. It's a lot of uncertainty this week because we got a lot of quarterback changes.
Yes, I was going to bring that up. Well, any close it out, Dave?
Thing that I wrote about in my column that I think is interesting and I'll point everybody towards is this Minnesota-Detroit game. And I wrote a little bit this week about this idea of a trap game, right? People are talking about this game as if it's a trap line because the 10-2 Vikings are visiting the Lions and they're underdogs to the lowly Detroit Lions who are laying 2.5 points. And some people are in disbelief about this, right? They're like, how could this be? It must be a trap. It's so obvious that the Minnesota should be the favorite. And so I wrote a little bit this week about how win-loss records mean nothing, right? Statistically, they don't mean anything. They mean everything for who gets in the playoffs and how we decide all of that. But they're not a stat. And when you evaluate teams, you don't evaluate them based on how many games they won or lost. So because every week you're matched up with a different team and there's different, you know, those matchups present different challenges from week to week. Detroit and Minnesota match up very well. I think that this is a game that will be very close. And Detroit's defense has improved a lot over the last few weeks. I like Detroit. I actually bet money on it. I think the number's in the right spot. So I do think it's going to be a bit of a sweat. I lay 2. You can get 2.5 right now. But I do think it's an interesting thing to talk about and folks should read my column about it. But yeah, I think this is the trap is that we as bettors fall into is thinking that a win-loss record says anything about how good a team is relative to another team.
Well, and for those that have not in over the course of these 14 weeks, if you haven't figured out why we have Dave on to talk about the NFL, is because of the parallel to racing, where if you listen to Andy Serling on a regular basis, you know that when it comes to horses, the win-loss and the recency bias and all of those elements are equally unimportant, ultimately, when you're shuffling the deck and putting PPs together for any particular race. And it's one of those obvious parallels about sports betting and horse race betting.
Yeah, I think Minnesota's like a horse that's won a lot of races in short fields, and you know what I mean. We're moving up in class. We see that all the time in racing, where a horse may have an undefeated, you know, record, and it's moving up in class, and it's going to be a big long shot because of the class jump. And so this is the same in football, where the record don't mean much. It's really, you need to dig into the stats and look at how a team has performed. Minnesota has a very big number of negative net yards this season. The turnover differential. I mean, if you look at the stats, they're maybe the worst 10-2 team in NFL history.
and by all rights should have been 9-3 coming into the week after the Jets game the other day. As always, invaluable Dave Hill. You got to follow, and as soon as this column comes up at nytimes.com, we will get it out in the hands of everybody. Dave, I appreciate it, and we'll talk next week. I'll be at Oklahoma. I'll be at Remington Park.
Have a great time. Good luck, everybody.
I appreciate it. Dave Hill, folks, and one of our absolute favorite people. We're going to turn and bring in Catherine Scanlon and talk about her book. I like I've said several times this morning, it is so different and unusual. But of course, because it has a racetrack bend to it, it's of instant interest and appreciation by race goers and race trackers and anybody that has an interest. And you know, the racetrack is such a colorful place. Anyway, let's find out how Kick the Latch came to be. Catherine Scanlon joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
I've been telling people all morning, Andy Serling originally brought up the book about 3 weeks ago, Catherine, and he said he just absolutely loved it. And with some research, he was able to catch up with you and what I've read of it so far. And it's an easy, fast read. It's just remarkable and it's unusual. And we got to know the backstory. We got to know more about you and how you were drawn to the story to begin with.
Thank you so much for reading it and for inviting me. So the book came to be because Sonia was someone that my parents knew from the antique business, and she was someone that they had talked to, and my mom in particular had talked to a lot and thought that she just had amazing stories and thought that I should talk to her. So I ended up meeting her and then ended up writing this book about her, which is based on conversations with her that I recorded and then transcribed and then worked with and wrote into the book.
You yourself had no racetrack connections.
I mean, I have kind of tangential racetrack connections. I grew up with horses, first of all. My mother is a horse lover. I had a horse of my own when I was a kid. Started riding at a really early age. And then my dad also owned racehorses when I was a kid. And, you know, went to the track when I was a child also. We went to Arlington a few times. My dad's originally from Chicago, so we would go there when we went to visit his family. At one point, we had a retired racehorse living at our house.
Hmm.
But not, you know, I'm not an expert, or, you know, everything that's in the book is, you know, that is about racing and about training and all of it. You know, it's all based on the things that Sonia told me after, you know, spending a lot of her life in that world.
I guess we should jump to the format and also your, you know, your direction as a writer, because I mean, it's being described as fiction, but it's really not.
It's kind of, I mean, I still maintain that, you know, I call it fiction, but I also maybe have a different idea of fiction than some people do. But I think that, you know, it wasn't like the form had to be something that artistically, like, I, you know, was pleasing to me, and so I feel like I had to be able to take like certain liberties in constructing the book, you know, instead of trying to do this sort of like, oh well, I have to make this kind of like faithful, you know, nonfiction account. You know, it's not a biography. It's definitely a novel, but yeah, it is kind of, you know, in this in between place where, you know, it's obviously, you know, very much based on this actual life. But, you know, formally and stylistically, I feel like it has the elements of fiction. It has the elements of a novel.
That's what's so unusual. I mean, it feels like an oral history that married a first person account that's a hybrid as told to. It is biographical in terms of structure, right? I mean, it literally starts with Sonia saying, "I was born October 1st, 1962. I mean, call me Ishmael. Did you set after these interviews, because the interviews took place over how many years?
The first one was in 2018, and then I kind of worked on the book a little bit. I started putting it together, set it aside for a while, and then I was going to go back to Iowa and see if I could meet up with her again and talk to her again in person, but then the pandemic happened, and I ended up, you know, not really going anywhere for a long time. I live in California. And so then I ended up reconnecting with Sonia by phone, and we had several phone calls that I also recorded and transcribed. And so those were in 2020 and 2021. And then I finished the book after those.
Amazing. Does she want to be known? I mean, in terms of publicity from this?
When I was working on the book, I sort of assumed, because all the names are changed in the book.
Sure.
Except for her first name. And I originally was going to change her first name, but I asked her what she thought about that. And she said that she would be, you know, honored for it to just, you know, stay her original name. So that that stayed that way. But otherwise, you know, it's like, I'd like to, you know, protect her privacy a little bit. And but she, you know, this is something that I worked closely with her, you know, along the way, just, you know, getting her permission at every step of the way, making sure that she was happy with the book, you know, sending her drafts, all of this, you know, to make sure this was something that she was comfortable with and happy to go ahead with.
From what we can tell, this was, as you mentioned, a friend of your mother's, and or you were introduced by your mother, and I'm just the whole thing to me is pretty remarkable. It just, because those of us that are around the game, you know, we're drawn to these kinds of stories, and it's such an interesting world and lifestyle, and it does seem that, you know, artists of all kinds are drawn, you know, to the racetrack and to racetrackers, because, I mean, let's face it, it's something of, it's an anachronism, and you know, something that it just is smaller. It's a smaller and smaller world. I mean, the circus life it's a throwback, and it just seems that people are drawn to these stories.
Yeah. I mean, they're incredible stories. There's just so much texture and interest and just really incredible things. My editor for the U.S. edition was talking about how when she first read it, she kind of had this idea in her head that Sonia was a lot older than she was, and that this took place, you know, a lot further in the past than it did. And then she kind of realized, you know, like, oh, that, you know, realizing the date, you know, when Sonia was born, which has been changed a little bit, but, you know, approximately the same. So she realized that she and Sonia were like similar in age, and she just was thinking that this seemed like such a, like you say, anachronistic, like it just feels like a different time in some ways, this kind of world. And that's definitely part of the reason, you know, I'm interested in it.
Your other work and in terms of a format, and I'm curious how your editor reacted. You know, you're following Dave Hill, who is also a writer, and is also drawn to Carney life. I mean, literally. I mean, his family comes out of that, you know, that milieu. His most recent book, The Vapors, which has been a bestseller, he had to rework it. His editors actually had him basically rework the book. did this format, was it instantly received, or was it the, you know, the result of you know, some massaging?
Well, it was the result of a lot of massaging by me.
Okay. Yeah,
but it didn't really, you know, once it went to the editor and to, and they, you know, wanted to publish it, there weren't really any changes made. I mean, you know, like few small things that we went over in the edits, but yeah, nothing substantive.
I bring this up, and I'm sort of stressing this just because it, you know, from a chapter standpoint, and from a the way in which the story unfolds, it's quite something. I mean, there's literally chapters that are a paragraph, and then there's chapters that are, you know, pages, and they're basically stories, and I imagine in a lot of ways, Catherine, that if we listen to the tape recordings that you took, that's really, you know, it's lifted, not verbatim, but it you know, there's little episodes, and then there's longer stories that are involved as her life and her career unfolded.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, like part of the interest for me in writing this book was just, you know, Sonia's voice and the way that she told stories, you know, and the kinds of details that she included. And so, yeah, I wanted to, you know, preserve a lot of that in the book. And so there are, you know, there are lines, there are passages that are, you know, pretty close to like verbatim from the transcripts. But then, you know, as far as like structuring it and, you know, and writing these into these little stories and these vignettes, chapters, whatever you want to call them, you know, it actually was a lot of work. It was a lot of rearranging. It was a lot of sort of reimagining and trying to create this arc of her life, which, you know, because conversations, it's like, yeah, she told a lot of little stories, and that's, you know, a large part of why the form is the way that it is. But when you're having a conversation with someone, you know, and especially like kind of about their entire life, like it's very ranging, you know, like it's kind of a, you know, wandering sort of, you know, speech, you know, natural speech, especially a casual conversational speech, is very kind of unwieldy in a way. So yeah, it was a lot of sort of like wrangling to try to figure out how to structure this book.
And as soon as people pick it up, kick the latch, Catherine Scanlon, as soon as they pick it up, and we'll get to that and make sure people know how to find it and order it and give it as gifts, because it this is going to find a place on everybody's you know, racetrack read library. It's one of the amazing things, Catherine, about you know, the people that buy books when it comes to horse stories and the racetrack stories. There's this wide range. I mean, there's literal, you know, literal books about horse, you know, the physical presence of horses, the body language of horses, which is Bonnie Ledbetter, and then ranging into, you know, novels and handicapping books and biographies of horses and jockeys and trainers and owners, and it's such a great, you know, horizon really of topics. And that's one of the things about this that is amazing, because all the parts of the components of anybody that is in the game is included in here. And I'm not even done. I'm halfway through. So then there's the real human, you know, there's the animals, which you obviously, based on your previous writing, you've got a real affection for. I mean, that feels like what you're, you know, you're drawn to, you know, the animal side of it. Her personal, her the personalities in her life, equine and human, are some of the best moments in the book. That early chapter of Bicycle Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
I mean the placement of that story, and of course, it's a childhood reminiscence, but the placement in here, that's sort of a grab you moment early on. I mean,
mm-hmm.
right? That she talks more about a neighborhood character even than her own family in the scheme of you know the early chapters.
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's kind of funny because when I was having that first conversation with her, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do with this recording. You know, I didn't really have any idea like that I would write, you know, this book or, you know, I just wanted to talk to her and was interested to talk to her. But when she started telling that story about the woman that's called Bicycle Jenny in the book, that was kind of the moment where I was like, I think that, you know, there's something here. This just feels, this is such a great story.
We got about six, seven minutes. Catherine Scanlon is with us, and you can, first of all, find Catherine, in a variety, there's a variety of places, her website and on Twitter, K_Scanlon_SCANLAN, Catherine Scanlon's, website as well, and then of course the literary side of it. CatherineScanlon.com is Catherine's website. It's Catherine with a RYN. The book is distinctive, and so is the spelling of your first name. talk about the reaction. Have you been surprised by how much you know, how affecting the way the book has affected people?
Yeah, I mean, definitely not in any way that I, you know, I don't know. I think I'm just always surprised when people are reading and liking my work. And you know, I loved this book and loved this story. But there just really have been a lot of people and a lot of different kinds of people, you know, and people with different interests and coming from a different place in life and different ages that have, you know, sent me messages or that I've heard from or talked to in person that have really liked it. And it's just really pleasing to me because, you know, this is someone's life that I've written about. And so I just, you know, I really wanted to make sure that I made something that kind of did justice to it or paid tribute to it in a way that, you know, as an artistic object, that it would be sort of worthwhile.
Was your direction always toward writing? Because it feels like, and I'd love you to talk about your other work, The Dominant Animal and August 9 Fog. Did you always know you were going to write?
Yeah, I did, actually. I mean, I started early, you know, as a child and kind of kept doing it. And it's what I went to college for and graduate school for. And it's just always been the thing that I wanted to do.
from a biographical standpoint yourself, I mean, your background, Midwest?
Yeah, I grew up in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Where'd you go to school?
At the University of Iowa. It was, Iowa City is like an hour or so from where I grew up, so I would go there a lot when I was a kid with my mom and always just really liked it there. And then, you know, they happen to have a really good writing program. And, I didn't go there for graduate school for the workshop, but I got to participate in, like, the undergraduate workshop there, which was really just a cool thing to be able to do. And, you know, to be able to go to a state school and do that was great. And then I went to graduate school at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago.
Very nice. You have a rapt following, that is clear. And so, you know, the, the reception of the work and the originality of it is just, it just feels, I mean, it just had to, it had to get a spotlight. Talk about your other two, projects.
Yeah. So, The Dominant Animal is a collection of stories that was published in 2020. It was published kind of right at the beginning of the pandemic, so it was a little unfortunate. But that was it's a book of very short stories. There's 40 in the collection. It's about 120 pages long, I think. And those are all stories that I had been working on for about 10 years, kind of pretty much since I finished graduate school and started working on, you know, towards compiling that. And then my first book is Ognine Fog, which was published in 2019. And that is a book that's based on a diary that I found that a woman who was in her 80s kept in Illinois from 68 to 1972.
When you say you found it,
it was part of you know, my parents are antique dealers, and I go to a lot of tag sales and auctions with them over the years, and that was something that, you know, I found that during the time that there was like a period of a few months between when I finished college and was preparing to move to Chicago, where I was living with them, and we were going to a lot of sales, and so that diary was something that it was going to get thrown away after an auction because no one had bought it, and it really, you know, it looks rough, like it, you know, it's it kind of looks like something that might get thrown away, but I started looking at it and then was just realizing what an incredible document it was and how interesting it was, and so that's also a book that kind of in tandem with the stories I was working on for about 10 years, just in the way of like trying to think about it and think about how I could make it into a book and thinking about what that book would look like.
Well, so people are basically going to order all three. Kick the Latch, The Dominant Animal, and August 9th, Fog. Is it somewhat formatted like Kick the Latch? Is that where, did you sort of get your sea legs toward Kick the Latch with August 9th?
I definitely, when I was, you know, thinking about Kick the Latch and sort of like conceptualizing it as a book, I definitely was thinking about it as kind of a continuation of Ognine, like, you know, just continuing to sort of like pursue this idea or this project. It's Ognine, I would say it looks more like almost like a poetry book. That there are usually only a few lines on each page. And this was something that was sort of whittled down from, you know, this massive original document, which is 5 years. It's a 5-year diary, the original, and it's just a huge amount of entries and information. But Ognine's a pretty spare, very spare book.
Well, just delighted to get the opportunity to introduce Catherine Scanlon to everyone. Our audience loves books and of any ilk regarding racetrack life, horses, the game. It'll be snatched up. Kick the Latch, which has gotten just raves from literary circles, and it will from our audience as well. And Andy Serling loved it, and he's a discerning reader. Catherine, thanks so much for this.
Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it.
Not at all, and congratulations. Catherine Scanlon, everybody, and Kick the Latch. You're going to want to order it. Basically, we hate directing people to Amazon, but let's be honest, that's the logical place, and get all of Catherine's.
Bookshop.org is actually a great website.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that's like similarly easy, I would say, as Amazon, but
and probably trickles more money into the hands of writers.
Well, it actually, as far as I know, they give a portion of all of their sales to local independent bookstores,
the booksellers. Dave Hill has pushed bookstores as well for his writing. Catherine, thank you. This was great.
Thanks again. I appreciate it.
Not at all. Catherine Scanlon, everybody. And there's our Thursday get-together. Dave Hill, Vic Stauffer, Andy Serling, and Sirewatch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. It's a good Thursday race day. Aqueduct and so much more. Everybody's starting to get into gear, and we'll have a big Oaklawn, LoSalle kind of a weekend preview tomorrow when we're together. Replay tomorrow, 6 to 9. Archive podcast later, and I will talk to you tomorrow. Thanks, everybody.
It's At the Races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hoof